Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, May 4, 2018, during a live Courthouse Steps teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleform conference call. This afternoon, we are hosting a Courthouse Steps decision discussion on SAS Institute Incorporated v. Iancu. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Mr. Matthew J. Dowd, who is a founder and partner at Dowd Scheffel PLLC. Also with us is Mr. Brian Pena, who is a partner at Wiley Ryan LLP. After hearing from our speakers today, we will move to an audience Q&A. Thank you both for speaking with us. Matthew, I believe the floor is yours to begin.
Thank you, Wesley. It's a pleasure to be here again, and thank you for having us and giving us the time to talk about SAS Institute versus Iancu. Here with a former partner of mine, Brian Pandya, and as we go through the case today, we will be going back and forth on different aspects of it. Before we get into the details, I'd like to give you a quick overview of what we'd like to cover, a few of the topics. To begin with, SAS Institute is a very interesting case. It is the case that will probably have the most impact on patent law practice in the near term. But beyond patent law, the decision is also an interesting case study in competing approaches to statutory construction. And in addition to that, there's the percolating issue of Chevron deference and to what extent, if any, this current court, the Supreme Court, will continue to apply Chevron, or will the court decide that Chevron has run its course and the question about statutory construction is one solely for the judiciary and not for the administrative state. So we will try to touch on each of those as we proceed through the case. We'll stop at various times for questions if there are questions, and we look forward to getting into the details of the case. Turning to SAS Institute, this is a case that involves a new scheme for reviewing issued patents from the Patent Office. In 2011, as many of you know, the Congress passed the American Invents Act, and that instituted or created a new post-grant review scheme through which anybody, including accused infringers, could challenge the validity of issued patents. And the current dispute, which is between SAS Institute and Compliments-Off, is precisely one of these. In this case, SAS Institute sought inter partes review of Compliments-Off software-related patent. The patent itself contains 16 claims, and SAS Institute sought PTO review of all 16 claims. The board, this is the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, chose to institute review on only some of the claims, and specifically claims 1 and 3 through 10, and it denied review of the rest. And that really brings us to the statutory dispute, or the dispute that was decided by the Supreme Court in this case. And with respect to the specific statute, we are looking at 35 U.S.C. 318A. And that statute authorized or commanded the director to issue a final written decision with respect to the patentability of any claim challenged by the petitioner. And the question really was, under that statutory provision, does that give the PTO through the Patent Trial and Appeal Board the discretion to institute review on only some of the challenged claims? Now, getting right to the holding of the case, which many of you may know already, the majority opinion, and this was a 5-4 decision, the majority opinion held that 318A is clear on its face, and it requires the Patent Office to institute review on any and all claims that a petitioner has challenged. And this is a significant departure from what was until this past week, the Patent Office's practice of instituting only on some of the claims, in other words, partial institution. Now, as I mentioned, it was a 5-4 decision. Justice Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion. There were two dissenting opinions, one a short one by Justice Ginsburg, and a longer and more nuanced one by Justice Breyer. As we go forward, I will provide a summary of the majority of opinion. Then I will turn it over to my colleague, Brian Tandia, and he will talk about the dissenting opinions as well as discussing some of the implications with respect to Chevron. After that, we will talk about some of the practical and strategic implications of the decision. And those issues get more into the nuts and bolts of practice before the Patent Trial and Appeal Board and IPR practice. So with that being said, let me turn to the majority opinion. And in some respects, the majority opinion is quite remarkable because Justice Gorsuch provides a very, very short and very, very concise conclusion or explanation that there was absolutely no ambiguity in the statute and that the statute is clear on its face. And his analysis hinges on two terms or two phrases in the statute or in the section 318A. The first is shall issue, and then the second is any claim challenged by the petition. Turning to standard statutory construction doctrines, he looked at the meaning of those terms as they're used in the statute, as they're used commonly, as they're used by dictionaries, and concluded that the phrase shall issue is non-discretionary, meaning that the PTO does not have any discretion on whether to issue a final decision on all the claims. Then the second aspect of his textual analysis is what was meant by any claim challenged. And here, turning to dictionary definition, in particular the OED, any means any and all. So when read together, there was no question and no ambiguity about the statute. And that in by itself was enough to convince the majority that full institution or was required and that partial institution was not authorized under the statute. Now, beyond that, the majority did address a number of the competing arguments that were presented by the PTO or by Compliments Soft. And I will run through all but not I'll run through some but not all of these because I think they're instructive, but we'd like to get to some of the more interesting aspects of the implications of the decision. So, for example, the majority responds to the PTO's argument that things are not quite as simple as they seem, meaning that when read in the context of the overall statutory scheme, there's more to this than simply looking at the words of 318A. And I think there's something to that, but at the same time, the majority does provide a quite convincing counter-argument. So, for example, the majority looks at Section 311A. It says the party may file a petition to institute an IPR. The majority also looks at Section 314B, and in particular, that section talks about whether to institute an IPR pursuant to a petition. In this respect, the majority looked at this and concluded that it provided a binary choice. It was not whether to institute and what to what extent to institute. So it was just directly tied to the petition itself. Interestingly, the majority also looked at the similarity between district court litigation or traditional civil litigation, in which the plaintiff generally controls the scope of the complaint and the scope of the civil action by setting forth the allegations in the complaint, comparing that to the way Congress established the post-grant procedure, in many provisions tying it to the issues that were presented in the petition by the petitioner and not tied to the director's decision. So from a textual standpoint, the majority often compared, or in many instances compared, the language choices used by Congress in establishing post-grant review to those that Congress had previously used when establishing ex parte reexamination, which is an older, more established method of challenging post-grant an issued patent. But as the majority pointed out on several occasions throughout the opinion, the language used by Congress when establishing post-grant or, sorry, ex parte reexamination gave a lot more discretion to the director, and it often tied the scope of the reexamination to individual claims and individual grounds for reviewing the claims. Now, in addition, the majority did address the policy argument that was presented by the PTO and by Compliments-Soft. And here, the issue was whether it is efficient to require the Patent Office to issue a final written decision on challenges that it had preliminarily decided were not reasonably likely to lead to success in invalidating the claims. And the majority, I thought, provided a cogent explanation of why that policy basis cannot trump the plain language of the statute. Ultimately, the majority doesn't say one way or the other which policy choice is better or which way is more efficient. It simply says that it is up to Congress to make those policy choices. And to quote, policy arguments are properly addressed to Congress, not this court. So the PTO is no longer allowed to partially institute reviews of patents in the IPR process. It must either institute based on every challenge presented by the petitioner or deny institution. This does raise, and there are some unanswered questions that go to how the PTO will address the holding and address SAS moving forward. We'll turn to that momentarily, but what I will do now is turn it over to Brian Pandia to discuss the dissenting opinions and get into some of the aspects with respect to Chevron. Brian?
Okay, well, thank you, Matt, for that detailed summary. And I'm going to talk about the dissenting opinions, and there actually were two dissenting opinions. One was a paragraph-long dissent by Justice Ginsburg, which I'm going to mention briefly. Then I'll spend most of my time talking about Justice Breyer's lengthier dissent that I think really shows the fault lines that are emerging on this court when it comes to issues of statutory interpretation, Chevron deference, and this case, although being a patent law case and really extraordinary in a patent law case to have a 5-4 split, shows the disconnect of the court. So first, Justice Ginsburg gave a paragraph-long dissent, was joined by Justice Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, and she accused the majority of taking a, quote, wooden reading of Section 318. And her argument was that, as she tried to highlight the practicality or the impracticality of what this is going to create, where the PTAB no longer has discretion to only institute review on claims that it deems meritorious. So now it either has to take an all or nothing approach, or it needs to perhaps issue a decision it could also reject instituting review, but say there is an issue as to some claims and give the petitioner a chance to file an amended petition or an additional petition, which is significant because, as I'm going to talk about in a minute, there is an issue of whether reviewability of institution decisions. So, and what this, one of the major things this case changes is that because if inter-parties review is instituted, it has to be on all claims and all bases. Now every single claim can be appealed to the Federal Circuit, whether it's a finding that the claim is unpatentable or whether it's patentable, depending which side you're on. Let me now talk about Justice Breyer's dissenting opinion, which I think was the more remarkable decision. This was joined by Justice Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan, except as to one subsection, which I'll talk about separately. The first sentence of Justice Breyer's dissent, I think, summarizes how he viewed the case, and frankly, a lot of us that attended the oral argument, including both myself, Matt and myself, viewed this case. Here's what Justice Breyer said. Quote, "This case requires us to engage in a typical judicial exercise, construing a statute that is technical, unclear, and constitutes a minor procedural part of a larger administrative scheme." Let's unpack that sentence. Typical judicial exercise, nothing remarkable, nothing to see here. And again, if you were at the oral argument, it almost at times felt like the court was biding its time to fill up an hour. It did not seem to be a case that anyone imagined would result in a sharply split 5-4 decision. Next, he says the statute here, Section 318, the statute is technical. Okay, well, that's, I think, true of almost any statute that involves a regulatory agency, and certainly one involving patents or intellectual property. Now, he says it's unclear. So, again, we're starting to smell the fumes from Chevron. And he says it constitutes a minor procedural part of a larger administrative scheme. So the way the dissent is looking at the issue in this case is that it's procedural. What does the PTAB review? Now, even though they call it procedural, whether inter-parties review is instituted on a claim has a great impact on whether you can appeal the decision. And, of course, it goes to whether a patent is patentable, whether the claims are valid and can be enforced against someone, or whether you lose your patent rights. And then he says it's part of a larger administrative scheme, which I'm sure hearing those words probably was like fingernails on a chalkboard for Justice Gorsuch and some of the other members of the majority. Now, not surprisingly, Justice Breyer took the view in his dissent that the relevant statutory phrase was ambiguous, or, in his words, leaves a gap that Congress implicitly delegated authority to the agency to fill. Because maps of the language here is 35 U.S.C. 318A, and the crux of the dissent was that the language, any patent claims challenged by the petitioner, was ambiguous as to whether that was any patent claims challenged by the petitioner in the original petition or challenged in the ultimately instituted inter-parties review proceeding. And it's often the case that, well, at least before this decision, that while the petition would raise a number of claims, inter-parties review was only instituted on a subset of claims. So having found the statute ambiguous, then we got to step two of Chevron, and he looked at whether the Patent Office's interpretation of 318A was reasonable. Now, to demonstrate reasonableness, Justice Breyer gave an example, which is not unrealistic, of a petitioner challenging 16 patent claims. The PTAB might find that only that the challenge raised as to one claim had a substantial question of patentability, which is the threshold, raised a question of patentability and was a reason to institute review. He argued it would be reasonable in these circumstances for the PTAB to institute review and proceed to a final determination on only that one claim where it felt there was a meritorious issue of patentability raised, and not be burdened with the 15 other claims where there was no dispute. And what's interesting here is if you think back to the oral argument back in November, now one of the questions that were raised, I can't remember which justice asked this question, maybe you can, Matt, But the question, I think it may have been from Justice Kennedy, but I'm not sure. But he said that he asked the counsel for SAS, what are you asking us to do here? So let's say that the patent, the PTAB finds that there is no question of patentability as to the claims where inter-parties review was not instituted. Did they just at the end of the IPR institute a one-line decision that says there's no question of patentability, so you can take it up to the Federal Circuit and appeal it? And that was kind of dismissed as an end run around the Cuozzo case that I indirectly mentioned earlier, saying that only final decisions of the PTAB were reviewable, not initial decisions. But so what Justice Breyer said here is that in these circumstances where a petitioner challenges a number of claims, there's a question of patentability as to only some of those claims, the PTAB should have discretion to either institute review on all of them, proceed to a written determination, and in that case there would be you could have an appealable decision as to all the claims. The PTAB could do what he said is more efficient. I don't think anyone disagrees would be more efficient, for at least for the PTAB, maybe not for the parties because they couldn't appeal it, but only to look at the claims where they felt there was a challenge. And he argued that was consistent with the policy goal of not just resolving validity disputes between a petitioner and a patent owner, but the broader public goal of weeding out invalid patents. Or the PTAB, of course, has discretion just to not institute review if it doesn't think the petition on the whole is meritorious enough. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there was one section of the dissent that Justice Kagan did not join, and that was Section 3A of the dissent. And I'm going to read a few sentences from it. It's really, a remarkable paragraph, and I think Matt and I slightly disagree as to why Justice Kagan did not join it. And Matt, if you want to chime in a minute with your view, but I'll tell you my view here. So in Section 3A of the dissent, which was Justice Breyer joined by Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor, he said that in referring to Chevron, I do not mean that courts are to treat that case like a rigid black-letter rule of law, instructing them always to allow agencies leeway to fill every gap in every statutory provision. Rather, I understand Chevron as a rule of thumb guiding courts in an effort to respect that leeway which Congress intended the agencies to have. And he goes on to say that I recognize that Congress does not always consider such matters, but if not, courts can often implement a more general, virtually omnipresent congressional purpose, namely the creation of a well-functioning statutory scheme by using a canon-like, judicially created construct, the hypothetical, reasonable legislator. Now, those of us that are patent lawyers are probably laughing at it. It sounds kind of like the person of ordinary skill in the art and other imaginary constructs we have in patent law. But he goes on to argue that the question should be asking what such legislators, the hypothetical, reasonable legislator, would likely have intended had Congress considered the question of delegating gap-filling authority to the agency. Now, my view on this is that the reason Justice Kagan did not join in this paragraph was the notion of the hypothetical, reasonable legislator who Congress intended, although did not always consider such matters, to be the judicial gap filler. I think that was a bridge too far for Justice Kagan. Matt, if you want to go ahead and explain your view on that, but just one other thing I'll say here is that I think Matt and I both agree that this shows the vulnerability of Chevron deference, that may be an issue for future terms, especially with Justice Gorsuch's influence on the court and some previous decisions by the Chief Justice and by Justice Alito, Justice Thomas, and others, questioning the scope of Chevron deference and how much authority the agencies have. And if I can just make one other parenthetical comment, if we think back to the National Lawyers Conference back in November, when Judge Kethledge from the Sixth Circuit talked about his book, talked about statutory interpretation, and he asserted that a lot of judges are too willing to find ambiguity in the statute to get to the second step of Chevron, and he claims that he has never never he, he's never found such an ambiguity, and if judges just work harder, they can usually resolve it on the first step by looking at what the statute means without finding ambiguity and giving deference to the agency. And I think that what the majority decision shows here is kind of a growing influence of that trend, especially being led by Justice Gorsuch. But Matt, if you want to chime in with your views on why you think Justice Kagan did not join this section of the dissent, and then we'll turn it over and talk a little bit about how the PTAB is implementing this decision and some of the actually very profound changes that are underway with PTAB practice.
All right, thanks, Brian. I'm not certain whether I could get quite inside the mind of Justice Kagan, but I will add one small point on the Chevron issue. It might be a minor point, but I think it's worth noting. So in the majority opinion, let me step back one second. Before the case was decided, there was a lot of discussion and chatter that this case might be a vehicle through which the court would rein in Chevron. Interestingly, though, even the petitioner, SAS, was not asking the court to go that far. In their briefing, SAS, the petitioner, recognized that and actually argued that there was no need to set aside Chevron or cabin Chevron in any way because the statute was clear, and that's what the majority ended up doing. Although in the majority opinion, at the slip opinion at page 11, is where the court, the majority, talks about, and I will quote this as, let me just read this. So SAS replies that we might use this case as an opportunity to abandon Chevron and embrace the, quote, impressive body of pre-Chevron law, recognizing that, quote, the meaning of a statutory term is properly a matter for a judicial rather than administrative judgment, end quote. And that portion of the opinion is citing an older judge-friendly opinion out of the Second Circuit, Pittston. To be fair, I think that's a little bit of a – I'll put it this way. There's a little poetic license in terms of quoting that Second Circuit opinion, because that case, if you go back and read that case, it's really – summarizing or trying to highlight the fact that at that time there were these two lines of cases where one line of cases held that is statutory construction is solely for the judiciary, and then another line which was ultimately adopted by Chevron, or at least advanced by Chevron. So I read that at least as, you know, teeing up and maybe and clearly saving for another day the court trying to latch on the quote-unquote pre-Chevron law. And one last point about the majority opinion is that on that same page there's a footnote that is included that addresses Justice Ginsburg's argument about the practical implications of the case. And here I thought this was a well thought and a convincing response to Justice Ginsburg, because the majority says it may be more practical to do what Justice Ginsburg proposes, but that there's no reason to twist the words of the statute in order to accomplish that, because there's an alternative way to achieve what Congress may have intended. A good response to the policy argument. All right, let me put that. Do you want to say something, Brian?
Yeah. Actually, I did want to raise one more point before we start talking about some of the Patent Office guidance. You mentioned earlier, Matt, that a lot of people, that this case was seen as a vehicle to overturn Chevron, and I think that. I mean, I agree with that, but I'll push back a little bit. I mean, I think if we think back to the oral argument in November, the headliner of that day, that this case was argued on the same day as Oil States versus Greene's Energy. And Oil States was the high-profile case, was the one that got a lot of attention, which drew protesters outside the patent office or outside the Supreme Court day of a patent case, which is frankly unheard of. So I think, going into this term, oil states was seen as the case that would be that would rein in agency power. Then oil states turned out to be, a 7-2 decision upholding the constitutionality of the PTAB. And if we think back to the day of the argument, this was a case that was, there was even some debate or some whispers about why was certiorari granted in this case. What's the issue here? And it was kind of, if you looked at the tenor of the argument, I would have predicted that oil states would be 5-4. This case would be 7-2 in favor of the patent office, or maybe 8-1 or 9-0. And yet it wasn't entirely clear how the issues in this case differed from Cuozzo, which already addressed the reviewability of initial determination decisions, and really what was the issue here. And my view, and I'm curious your take as well, Matt, is that once Justice Gorsuch was relegated to the dissent with the Chief Justice in oil states, this was his way of pushing back, and to his credit, got 5 votes that I didn't think were possible. And said, if PTAB proceedings are going to be constitutional, here, Patent Office, here is how you have to do it. And so, I think this case needs to be read in the context of what happened in oil states. And I'll candidly and humbly admit that I never saw this case being a 5-4 decision. I was wrong on oil states too, so I don't know what that tells you. But I think this needs to be read in that context. So.
Brian, I completely agree. I think those are great points. And so there's a lot packed in there, both in terms of how to understand both of these cases in the context of agency action, the constitutionality of agency action, as well as the authority of agencies, in this case the Patent Office, to take particular actions and policy decisions given certain statutory constructs. In one way, maybe this is a signal to litigants moving forward that there'll be more or a greater chance of success if the approach taken is to really home in on the statutory language rather than trying a broader, more fundamental or profound challenge that's based on the Constitution. I like the point about the fact that Gorsuch, although he was the big proponent of challenging the constitutionality of the entire scheme in oil states, it was clear, Chief Justice Roberts assigned this case to Gorsuch, and he did carry the 5-4 majority. So a lot of interesting dynamics. Both in terms of the court and then overall implications in terms of administrative law and legal challenges moving ahead. So with that, I will move us to the next stage where we talk about some of the more practical and strategic implications of SAS as it is applied in post-grant proceedings under the American Vents Act. I'll give a short introduction to what the Patent Office has done so far, which is surprisingly quite a bit, and then I'll turn it over to Brian, and then we'll go back and forth and we'll talk about various issues. The big takeaway here, though, is that there is still a lot of unknowns for those who are practicing before the PTAB and have to deal with SAS and how it will be applied both in cases moving forward and pending cases. We'll touch on a lot of these in the time that we have remaining, which is about 25 minutes. So first, let me say that the Patent Office moved extraordinarily fast in issuing a guidance document. It was a one-page document, but it was guidance nonetheless. And the office issued this 2 days after the Supreme Court issued the decision in SAS. And on top of that, on April 30th, this past Monday, the chief judge of the patent trial, the chief administrative patent judge of the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, conducted a webinar in which three of the top leadership of the board provided their insight and views in terms of how SAS would be implemented at the agency, at the PTO, and recognizing that there are still many questions involved. And I'll just touch on a few of these before I turn it back over to Brian. So first, getting to the guidance document, this is April 26th. The key point taken from this is that the PTAB grant an IPR petition on either all claims or no claims. So there is no more partial institution. And if a petitioner challenges every claim in a patent, the board will institute on every claim challenged or no claims challenged. In addition, and this following point comes from the webinar from the Chief Administrative Patent Judge this past Monday, is that the Patent Office is taking the agency position that SAS also applies to grounds that are presented in the petition. And so let me unpack that just for a second. In as many of you may know, when these petitions are filed and the patent is challenged, there are basically two demarcations of what's being challenged: the number or the individual claims that are being challenged, and the quote-unquote grounds upon which each claim is being challenged. So if there's a patent and has two claims, each claim can be challenged on any number of invalidity bases, whether it's anticipated under 102, obvious under 103. If it's a PGR, you can challenge for a written description or enablement under 112. And the Patent Office has stated that it will institute review based on all claims and all grounds. And so again, if you have this patent that is, it has two claims and the petition is filed and it challenges each of those two claims on both, for example, anticipation and obviousness, then the board will, if it does decide to institute, it will decide to institute review of both of those claims for both of those grounds. And this is a significant change from past practice. Yeah. One question it does raise, though, is what will the board do with respect to decisions, initial decisions? And again, I haven't gone through all the details or the mechanics of it, but the process starts with the filing of petition. The board then issues an initial decision on whether to institute or not. And then at the end of the trial proceeding, which is about a year long, you get the final written decision. And so here the question is, now, given SAS and given the requirement that institution is based on all grounds and all claims, how will that affect the initial decisions or the institution decisions that the board does write? Until recently, they've often been quite lengthy, and they've provided explanations of why certain claims have a reasonable likelihood of being shown to be invalid and why others haven't. And what I'll do now is I'll turn that over to Brian, and he can give us a little more explanation or thought in terms of what the board may or may not do in that context.
Right. Well, I mean, I think as you noted, Matt, the great unknown is how is the board going to react now, having to take all claims and all challenges? And I think as you noted and as the chief judge of the PTAB noted, although SAS only requires the board to institute on all claims, but maybe not on all bases or all arguments raised, they're going one step further. And it'll be interesting if we see additional guidance. And I think everyone realizes that we're only 2 weeks past the decision here, and a lot could change between now and then. But my view is that the board is going to make a good faith effort to give at least reasonably detailed decisions. They don't want to run afoul of the Federal Circuit in giving one line, one claim decisions. Even though that's some some justices suggested the board could do that if the arguments were so weak there. But I think that would be I think that would raise the ire of the Federal Circuit. Now the initial the decisions on the initial determination that raises I think that raises some tactical issues. So if you're say representing a patent owner and the patent owner decides not to file a preliminary response, so I mean the way the way an inter-parties review proceeding works is that the petition's filed, the patent owner has the option of filing a preliminary response, and sometimes the patent owner would do that as a way to try to weed out certain claims. So if the petitioner was challenging 15 claims and the patent owner felt they had an argument as to say five of the claims, why there should not be inter-parties review instituted, they might file a preliminary response, hope that the board institutes on only a subset of the claims. If that was the case, then if there's co-pending district court litigation, the district court judge might be less willing to stay the litigation pending inter-parties review, just because not all claims are being adjudicated at the patent office. Now you have the situation where if it's going to be an all or nothing determination, does the patent owner file a preliminary response? I think that will impact how the board responds to the initial determination decisions. The one thing that concerns me here is that typically being on the defense side in district court litigations and accordingly on the petitioner side at the PTAB challenging the validity of patents is that let's see again the situation where the PTAB just looks at one claim, says there's a question of patentability here, IPR is instituted, and you don't know what the board thinks of the other the other challenge claims. Now it may be the case that if there's only one meritorious challenge to the validity of the claims and the other ones there's nothing there, that the board may be more willing to exercise its discretion not to institute review. But one of the things that is concerning and is a possibility is that you just look at initial determination decisions that are fairly pro forma and says there's a question as to one claim and it does not give you much guidance on the other claims. Where does that leave you? And that's going to make things more difficult on practitioners. And there is a lot of unknown, and a lot of uncertainty here. And so, I'm not sure I know. This does create a lot of uncertainty for practitioners. Certainly the appealability issues, the estoppel issues we have to contend with. I mean, one thing is we'll need to consider is, which arguments do you raise? Which claims do you challenge? And if you challenge fewer than all the claims, will the district court litigation be stayed? So, I think that raises the question of, should petitioners ask for review of more claims or fewer claims?
Right. Yeah, let me jump in there, Brian, because I think you raised a number of excellent points and a number of excellent questions, in fact. So, for example, let's take one. You mentioned whether district courts will stay cases in view of this new procedure. As many of our listeners likely know already, when there's a concurrent district court litigation and the accused infringer files a post-grant review in the patent office, the district court will often stay the district court litigation if the review or the IPR is granted and review is instituted. That's been common for a number of years. It also occurred during inter-parties reexamination and even ex parte reexamination, although it was less common in ex parte reexam because of the timeline or the longer time to get the decision for ex parte reexam. In any event, with respect to AIA proceedings, one of the sticking points of trying to get a stay in district court litigation, if you are in fact the accused infringer and you're petitioning for post-grant review, was this issue of partial institution. and the district court judges would see that the patent, while being reviewed at the patent office, was only being reviewed with respect to either some of the claims that were being asserted in district court or not all of the grounds for invalidity. And in those instances, the district court judge was much less inclined to grant the stay, and the district court proceeding would continue on a concurrent track with the IPR. Now, in our post-SAS landscape, the question will be what will happen, what will be more likely. A lot of this will depend on how the Patent Trial and Appeal Board responds to petitions and whether they're more likely to grant or not. If you have instances where there is a denial of institution of the post-grant review, but then in that institution decision, the board, while denying institution, says that it recognizes that there may be some validity issues with the claims, does that help a petitioner or not? It certainly doesn't help in terms of getting a stay, of course, because there won't be any concurrent post-grant proceeding. In the context of when the board grants on all claims, clearly that will, in my view, it will increase the likelihood of getting a stay in district court. One other issue, I think, which is complicated, probably more complicated than we have time to talk about today, is the estoppel issue you mentioned under 35 U.S.C. 315E. Estoppel attaches to claims or grounds for invalidity that could have been raised in the post-grant review, the IPR. Until recently, the estoppel provision has not been applied very rigorously, meaning that there were few instances in which parties were found to be estopped of asserting a grounds of invalidity based on a post-grant, like AIA proceeding. Now that the PTO will take the position that either all that is taking the position that all claims and all grounds can be instituted, this makes it a much more important decision deciding what, if any, grounds and claims are to challenge in the post-grant review. So really, like you said, Brian, a lot of unknowns, a lot of moving parts as we proceed forward. One other thing I would like to mention is the fact that the PTO or the PTAB is already making decisions or applying SAS to pending PTAB cases. So if any of you are listening today and you have pending cases, you likely have seen or you may have seen this already, in addition to the guidance document issued by the PTO. The board in many cases, or at least a number of cases, has issued supplemental institution decisions. So if a case is early enough, the board has gone back and decided to implement or institute review as a full institution, whereas it might have initially been instituted as only a partial institution based on some of the claims and some of the grounds of invalidity. And this, of course, raises issues about timing, discovery, introduction of evidence, argument. As you all know, the timeline of a post-grant review under the AIA is set by statute. They're very quick. They're fast. And there's not too much room for flexibility in the schedule or maneuvering. But the message from the chief APJ on Monday was essentially that the board will take a case-by-case analysis. I got the impression that the board will be very flexible in terms of accommodating, including additional claims and grounds that may not have been included at the institution stage or the very first institution stage, so they will likely supplement. And I've got the strong impression that the board is going to do whatever it can to include as much of this as possible in order to avoid a vacate and remand from the federal circuit if the case gets appealed. And on that point, as I mentioned before, the Federal Circuit was asking a number of parties this week. It's court week this week at the Federal Circuit, so parties are being asked the impact of SAS on pending appeals. So there are plenty of cases to watch to see how the Federal Circuit addresses those. So I wish we had all the answers to how SAS would apply to cases both pending and moving forward, but if nothing else, there'll be plenty for us to watch as we move forward. Let me see. With that, Brian, let me turn it back to you. Do you have any other particular points that
I do. I'll raise a couple more points and observations. And Wes, I don't know if you want to open the floor to questions, if you want to get some questions in the queue. If we, you know, we're happy to take some questions. But, you know, I'll while you do that, Wes, I'll go on a limb here. And I'm actually going to, you know, going to suggest that, you know, we'll see more you know, we'll see more instances or more situations where the PTAB exercises its discretion to decline to institute review, especially in instances where, you know, where there's you know, where the majority of the claims do not raise questions of patentability. So I think we will see that rather than the you know, the situation of you know, rather than the situation of a review being instituted and then getting to a final determination that the claims are patentable, then there's estoppel in the district court. And, you know, although I, you know, I did raise concerns about that earlier, I mean, on the other hand, I mean, one thing to think about is that in the, when you're at the PTAB, the burden of proving unpatentability or invalidity is lower. It's preponderance of the evidence standard. You get to the district court, it's clear and convincing evidence. You also have broader claim constructions, the broadest reasonable interpretation at the PTAB versus the Phillips claim constructions in district court, which, you know, where you can have, you know, different disclaimers and other means of narrowing claims. So, you know, I tend to think as a practitioner, I mean, it would be it's you know, certainly you don't want to be stopped from raising arguments in district court, and you know, you have different advocacy mechanisms in the district court than you do at the PTAB. You know, where it's a petition followed by, you can take some limited discovery. The board can make observations on that discovery, but it's a, you know, it's a much colder paper record than the live testimony you'd get in a district court. But I mean, on the whole, if you can't sustain your burden of proving invalidity in the PTAB, it may as a practical matter not matter that much in the district court. I mean, to be sure, there are reasons why you would rather challenge, you'd want to have your validity defenses in the district court, including to keep the, you know, to force the patent owner to take certain positions on claim construction on infringement. You know, those are all reasons, but I mean, that's you know, I do think that as this sorts out, it'll be interesting. A couple other things, I mean, again, we mentioned earlier whether the patent owner will waive filing its preliminary response. Will the patent owner disclaim certain claims if the patent owner acknowledges there's a validity issue with a handful of claims, but the other claims, probably dependent claims, do not raise such issues? You know, that's a tactic that was sometimes used in covered business method review to get rid of claims that were drawn to financial methods and kind of keep the other technological claims at play. We haven't seen that much in the IPR context, but maybe that happens now. You know, so that there are, again, a lot of interesting strategic things to sort out from this case on the part of petitioners, patent owners, and frankly, the board as this is implemented.
Yeah, okay, thanks, Brian. Wes, if there are any questions, we're happy to take them. Otherwise, I'm happy to add a couple more points.
Great. Well, just hold on to that thought. I'll open the floor to questions and see if we have any right away. Looks like we do have one question lined up in the queue. Brian and Matthew, are you okay moving on to this caller, or would you like to finish your thought?
No, let's hear the question. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, caller, let's move to you.
David Emerson with the Berkeley Federal Society chapter, and a practicing IP attorney for many years. On the practical implementation of this, and I apologize, I don't have the decision in front of me, but I do recall that one of the suggestions is that the PTAB could take a position of almost uniformly rejecting entirely the submissions for a review, but provide some guidance, provide some kind of narrowing, you know, instructions on
an acceptable application that they would be receptive to. So I'm wondering whether or not that will, in your estimation, become part of routine practice where you go through an additional step in the dance with the PTAB and then resubmit in a narrower form that they'll be accepting.
Right, yeah, no, this is Matt. Great question. And you're touching on the exact point that Justice Ginsburg makes in her one paragraph dissent. Basically, she says that, and I'll read it just to refresh everyone's recollection. The board could simply deny a petition containing challenges having no reasonable likelihood of success. Simultaneously, the board might note that one or more specified claims warrant reexamination, while others challenged in the petition do not. Petitioners would then be free to file new or amended petitions shorn of challenges the board finds unworthy of inter partes review. Why should the statute be read to preclude the board's more rational way to weed out insubstantial challenges? Great question. I think that's a great point by Justice Ginsburg. At the same time, you know, from a doctrinal interpretive standpoint, the majority addresses that and says that by recognizing that the PTO can do this, that's a reason that's a further reason to adopt the statutory textual construction that the majority does hold. Going to your specific question about the practicalities of this, it's my understanding, and this I got this impression from listening to the chat with the chief APJ as well as other people talking in the community. I do get the sense that the board will deny institution in cases where it seems either one, it's too complex, as a matter of discretion, it wouldn't be worthwhile to expend resources on it. Say, for example, there's only one claim that, like Justice Breyer's example, there's only one claim out of 20 or 30 that is deemed to raise a likelihood of being held invalid. In an instance like that, I do think that the board will be likely to deny it, but also provide an opinion that says, well, if you refile, not saying this expressly or explicitly, but suggesting as much that if you refile, then a refiled petition would be granted. Of course, the problem or the difficulty with that is that there are time bars that apply in certain instances to certain petitioners. I'll turn it over to Brian to see if he has thoughts.
Well, and I mean, I think there's not, I mean, in addition to the time bars, I mean, there are you know, certain restrictions on serial petitioning, and it's also costly. I mean, depending on your client, I mean, not every, you know, you have the initial filing fees. If review is not instituted, there's a partial refund, and I presume you'd have to pay the fees again. So, I mean, that is going to get costly for parties if that happens. I think it really comes down to why you need to pick your claims, present your petition in an organized manner that presents a roadmap for finding invalidity or unpatentability. But notwithstanding what I said a few minutes ago, I mean, I can also see the board taking the view. I mean, not exercising that discretion as much as Justice Ginsburg believes that they will. I mean, you know, for the board to analyze the claims, I mean, how much additional effort does it take to, you know, does not believe there's an issue of patentability in the first instance and nothing moves them, persuades them during the trial, during the proceeding at the patent office. I mean, it's not, we'll probably have to get more than one line, but it's not going to be an extraordinarily difficult opinion for the board to write. And now, then you get to a final reviewable decision by the Federal Circuit, and it goes up to the Federal Circuit, presumably will be affirmed, although it'll be interesting to see the first case where the Federal Circuit issues such a reversal, and if the opinions are short and cursory, maybe there will be more Federal Circuit reversals of the PTAB finding a claim patentable.
Do we have any other questions?
Looks like the queue is now empty, and also looks like we're at the top of our hour. So seeing that there are no more questions, Brian and Matthew, are there any closing remarks that either of you would like to make before we end the call today?
Thanks, Wesley. One last point I would like to make is, and this is maybe a point for further discussion, consideration by the community, is that SAS, the procedure that's now required by SAS could be fixed by a very simple statutory amendment, and we'll have to see whether the various stakeholders in the patent community garner enough interest to get Congress to revise the statute or not. With that, I'll turn it to Brian.
Well, yeah, and I don't have anything further to add, but, thanks, Matt, thanks, Wes, and thanks to everyone who joined the call today. This is a very interesting area, and, we didn't even touch on issues like amending patent claims during PTAB proceedings, which is something that I think the new director will be more, we'll see, the board will be more receptive to those approaches, and, so there's lots of interesting moving pieces here as we sort out this case, but thanks again to everyone who joined us this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Brian and Matthew. I do want to let everyone know that this call is being recorded to be turned into a podcast, so you'll be able to find this recording very soon on iTunes, Google Play, and on the Federal Society's website. So on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.